Once you arrive at the conclusion that the world isn't under any obligation to make you happy, forgiveness becomes a lot easier. Magnanimity becomes a lot easier. Patience becomes a lot easier.
Gratitude.
Sure.
You know, and serenity when you realize that you live in a world of cause and effect.
Isn't that just growing up?
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is February 11th, and it's nice and bright and early in the morning. And I want to get this going because I got a big day ahead of me. I'm excited to tell you about all the things I'm currently doing. First of all, where do you live? Hopefully not New England. Gee whiz, we are just getting creamed with snowstorm after snowstorm. There's supposed to be one like tomorrow. There's supposed to be another one this weekend. I think we already got about 3 feet out there. You know, and that's enough. Now, I love the snow. I enjoy looking at it from my window. I enjoy talking about it at the beginning of podcasts. But there has just been, you know, a lot of shoveling, a lot of on-street parking bans. And, you know, it's this would be a good time if you live someplace warmer, even if it's someplace shitty like Oklahoma. Count your blessings this time of year that you don't have to deal with this snow. Even though, like I said, snow is it's beautiful looking. I like to drive in the snow. I just got some new tires. That makes driving in the snow fun instead of life-threatening. So that's just really, you know, a side note, something that's kind of slowing things down around here. Right now, I'm actually in the middle of recording an enormous roundtable on the New Tragedy and Hope video, The Future of Freedom. It's Richard Grove's interview with the NSA whistleblower Bill Binney. And Rich, Kevin Cole, and I are going through this 2.5-hour presentation in 15-minute chunks and talking about it. So that will be coming on Peace Revolution Podcast sometime in the near future. I'll probably repost it. And I'm also working on writing the foreword for the second edition of Carlos Morales's book, Legally Kidnapped, The Case Against CPS. That turned out to be a big project because, as I've said before on the show, I am not a writer. But it's been an educational and enjoyable experience for me, and I'm glad I could help Carlos out with that, and I wish him great success with the second edition of his book. And I'm also in the process of editing that science series that I'm working on with Daryl Becker. We've recorded parts 2 and 3, and I'm really excited to see feedback coming in. The next show is going to be exclusively about communicating with people when there is disagreement on highly volatile and emotional subjects. The third installment is going to be about a book we talked about a little bit in the first show called Disciplined Minds. So you're going to have to be patient before we really, really get into the stuff that is going to blow people's emotions. And I'm still trying to figure out how all that's going to work out in the second half of the series. We probably won't even be getting into that stuff until mid-March. So, you know, just be patient. There's a lot of stuff in the old pipeline here. And I thought in the meantime, while I finish up working with Rich and Kevin. We have another 4-hour session of recording today. And while I finish up this project for Carlos, that I would toss this your way. I've been communicating with Antigone. She gave me permission to release this. It's a nice follow-up to the series that I recently did with Bill Buppert on the philosophy of Stoicism. We actually found another Stoic. His name is Nick. He joined our conversation. And we have a few tangents. It's more of a casual conversation, to be honest. And hey, I also have some items in my inbox here. I wanted to thank some people on the show. First of all the people who've joined our AV club, it's how we support the show. It's going really well right now. And I'm really, really grateful for all the support. And I will resume the old new subscriber geography trivia very shortly. As soon as I have time to start attaching those to the end of the shows, I will. I want to thank a couple of people who've recently made purchases for us off the Amazon wish list, and you can check that out at schoolsucksproject.com, and it is under the support tab if you are the kind of guy or gal who is into making my wishes come true. First of all, Brandon S. writes in, "Keep up the great work on School Sucks Podcast." And he purchased for us another microphone stand for a third mic. So now I can do discussions with 3 people in this studio instead of just 2. It is a floor-mounted mic stand. So the person in the third mic position can actually sit on a couch, which will be nice for them, while the other 2 people kind of have to sit at desks. But this third one is freeform. We could put it anywhere. We could put it outside. And attached to that is a mic that another listener named John, who's actually the host of a new podcast that I've been getting ready to recommend to you. It's called Agile Parents. John and I have actually been talking together most Saturdays for the last few months, trying to move both of our podcast careers forward and enhance them as we go. It's been a wonderful experience. John is a great new friend, and a little while back, he purchased for the show the Audio-Technica ATR2100 USB and XLR mic. You can put either into it, and that's useful if you got to go on the road for a while and you need to bring your laptop with you and you can't pack up a mixer and a compressor and microphone stands and all that. And it was an essential piece of equipment for doing discussions with three people in this room. We've tested it out a little bit. We're going to be recording the next Podcast Masters in this space. And finally, last but not least, Artie writes in on the little Amazon gift slip. I know it's late, but here's a 5-year anniversary gift. I went from collectivist, anti-capitalist supporter of schools to starting an educational company that will eventually combat schooling. Uncountable thanks, Brett. Artie. Artie purchased for us a nice little Sony HD Handycam that I'll be using in the very near future in a variety of productions. So how exciting. Thank you to Brandon, John, Artie. Oh, wait, I got another one. I drove through a snowstorm the other day to the post office because I heard there was a package waiting for me. And when I got there, I found the eye stabilizer tab mount. Let me tell you about this little beauty. This holds a variety of size tablets. It's adjustable, and you can just screw it onto a tripod. So you can use your tablet as either a camera or kind of like a teleprompter. Unfortunately, there was no gift slip in the box. Now, I think I can thank somebody named Martin H. for this, but I'm not sure. So if you were the person who purchased the eye stabilizer tab mount, please let me know who you are so I can thank you properly. So it's a busy week. Thank God for Evernote. Thank God for getting things done. Do you do those things? I really recommend them. All right, here's Sex, Lies, and Anarchy. We recorded this, gosh, a couple months ago. And I think it was like at the point where Bill and I had just recorded one or two shows in that Stoicism series. But now, all the way out here in February, it makes a nice follow-up to that series for people who are interested in the subject. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. More stuff is coming soon. Here's the show, and to all our listeners in the Southern Hemisphere, I hope you're having a great summer. Okay?
You found sex,
lies,
and anarchy.
If you wanna fly.
Broadcasting to you from our authentic 19th century farmhouse in the Liberty Haven of New Hampshire.
Liberty is about to get personal.
Listening to Sex, Lies, and Anarchy. I'm Antigone. I'm here with Brett of School Sucks Podcast.
Hey, it's great to be back.
And Nick.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me. So, Brett, on the last show of School Sucks, you had Bill Buebert on.
Yeah.
And I don't want to feel like I'm picking on him because the way I met him was he was on the opposite side, i.e. the wrong side, of a debate that I was in at Porkfest.
Yeah.
And the topic was abortion. And he mentioned me in some blog that he wrote and like some like jab or something. But the night after the big gay dance party, we bonded and we were hanging out. So I was like surprised that there was a little jab in there. I don't even remember now what it was. But he said some things that upset me again in this podcast. There were a couple of things. So I'm going to try to get to it all in one show.
Even though I certainly didn't agree with what he said, I feel like I should make an effort to defend him in his absence. So
right. I'm not going to pick on him at all.
That will maybe create some interesting podcasting.
Yeah. Podcasting.
Yeah.
The show was about Stoicism.
Yes.
And Nick here is in my phone as Stoics, We had this like debate amongst like three or four of us of whether or not he was stoic.
Mm-hmm.
And I know of a lot of people now, since I've been thinking about it, who only know the word stoic as, you know, being aloof.
Sure.
Rather than a philosophy with many writers having, you know, having taken credit for all of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there's big S and small s stoicism.
Sure.
One being a philosophy and one just being an adjective that we often use to describe people. When you are addressing Nick, which one are you talking about?
I'm using big S.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Right?
Yeah, because it's an adjective.
So, but the philosophy of stoicism and the asceticism that we were talking about, you find value in all of those things.
I do.
So he can defend Bill.
Okay. Oh, great. All
or,
right.
You know, oh, yeah, both of you against me, but I'm not attacking. So see, this is what I'm talking about. Empathy and cooperation. We don't need to attack and compete.
Yeah. So what I was wondering is what appeals to you about the asceticism?
I just find a certain value in living simply.
Yeah.
I think that there are things that you don't need. And I think that being able to live without those things is a valuable piece of information to know that you can.
I understand that as well. And it helped me better live into what I actually like wanted to do to make money. Like what I wanted to do for work was to first simplify my life and start from there and then say, okay, if I'm comfortable with this, I can actually do what I want. If I had built a life around the income I used to have, it would have been much more difficult for me to transition into doing what actually makes me happy. So another part of stoicism is obviously being prepared to have less, right? Through negative visualization, looking at the things that are important. Because even I think the most, you know, disciplined ascetic is not going to be able to strip out everything that they like and care about or enjoy out of their, I mean, that would be the point of life if you did that. But that would
well,
be like,
wouldn't that make you some kind of stoic monk? There are monks who go without human interaction and little to no food. Some claim to not have eaten.
I don't think there's anything in stoicism, the philosophy of stoicism, about sacrificing happiness or self-sacrifice at all. I don't think that that's what it's about. It seems like there's a lot of that in monasteries, and I don't understand that. But
Seneca, in his letters, writes to go with little to no food, coarse clothing, to go without, so that you know, is this all that I had to dread? And Buprit mentioned that, so that like at that point you realize, you know, the only thing worse that can happen to me is death.
Sure. Yeah. See, one of the things that I think is really appealing about the philosophy is I haven't read too much about what people wrote thousands of years ago about it. There are modern adaptations. Have you heard of Hormetism?
I have not, no.
Okay, so this is kind of like a more modern take, taking, you know, some pieces of Stoicism. But obviously, was it me last week on this show who said there's a few bat turds in every gold mine? Or was that somewhere else?
That was not on this show.
Oh, well, now it is.
Bat turds.
There's a few bat turds in every gold mine. So if you read these people who wrote in ancient Greece about it, there certainly might be some stuff they said that today we would find very off-putting. I just put out another show with Bill today, and we spent the first half hour of the show talking about objectivism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, objectivism has a lot of positives, but the personalities that that philosophy is known for, they're very unlikable people, you know?
I could say that about libertarianism today.
You bet. You bet you could. You know, and I just want to go on the record saying I'm not a fan of that Walter Block.
He's like a sweet grandpa. He's so nice.
I don't care for him.
I don't know what he's written lately.
He always seems like he's trying to look at what I came up with. Yeah, I don't know. He's trying to make people angry. He's like a troll.
I don't really have a strong opinion on him, but okay, you don't like Walter Block.
He doesn't strike me, and I know this is going to come up later in the show tonight. He didn't strike me as terribly empathetic.
Right.
He seemed like that was an afterthought at best in all of his formulation.
I would agree with you there.
Right. And that's just not somebody, I just don't care for that much.
Well, that is what I hear from libertarians.
Okay.
So I started using Twitter and I got added right away to an objectivist / ANCAP link or mm-hmm. something. And then outside of that, there are the anarcho-socialists out there and they have more empathetic language, but you can't make sure that everyone has access to everything you want them to have access to by forcing things. The only way you can do that is by keeping to the anarcho part.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In which case, We all do have access. We don't have anything in the way.
Right.
So Seneca, mm-hmm. and I know you already said the thing about the bat turds in the gold mine, but Seneca also wrote a lot about slavery.
Sure.
It was a great statement to say for statism when he was saying to be very kind to your slaves, because then they will bare their necks for you. Then they will not speak ill of you as they're being tortured, etc. And then he goes on to talk about how, one's household should be run like a little commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, how children are treated, etc. Children are treated in the society and in school, of course, that's the beginning of that, and how you should, you know, throw them some bread and circuses, and hence they will be better little slaves for you.
So it sounds like the template for basically the American democracy, right?
Indeed.
The way to treat your slaves to keep them slaves. That might be a little harsh, but it's in the ballpark, I think.
He also advised letting them get, you know, little like trinkets or something to say, oh, you were a good little slave today, like little gold stars, like you were the best one today.
Carrots and sticks.
This is great. So, but then as I'm reading about Stoicism, I read that he said he was disgusted with it.
Slavery.
Yes.
Yeah, I would think that having these really sometimes contradictory views and like this real intrapersonal struggle with the concept, it seemed to go on from, you know, whenever slavery and thinking existed together, like from ancient Greece to the days of Thomas Jefferson, people had these conflicts. I think that's understandable.
What is it? I think it was said that when you're surrounded in slavery, that's when people start writing and thinking about freedom.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So everyone's ready for the dystopian movie that this all leads to, right?
Yeah, I've prepared.
By being so stoic.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's going to be higher up in the train.
Well, I don't know about higher up. Trains like
in a costume. Oh, I recently saw this movie and I couldn't believe I hadn't heard of it before. It's called Snowpiercer. It came out in 2013 and it's on Netflix.
Okay.
So something happens. I don't remember exactly what. Nuclear, global cooling. And everyone that's left on Earth is on a train that goes around the entire Earth. And the people at the back of the train are like the workers or what have you that get fed protein blocks. And the people up top are the ones running the train.
Mm-hmm.
And the classes are very, you know, divided just like that. And, you know, stuff happens. So that's the latest, like, dystopian revolutionary film that I've seen. But for any of those situations to happen, you need to have this lack of empathy.
Absolutely.
That's the only issue I really have with Stoicism.
Where do you see the...
Cutting emotional ties. This is the only thing that, like, Nick and I were really debating, right?
If you change the word ties to dependence, I'd be, like, fully on board.
Emotional dependence?
Yeah.
See, here we go back to the asceticism and hermitude. I'm emotionally dependent on others. It would suck to be completely by myself. I'm a human.
Oh, it would suck, but I mean, to be emotionally dependent, I would say emotionally dependent is like broken heart death. Like your husband of 60 years dies and then you just keel over because of your broken heart. That's being emotionally dependent.
After 60 years, I mean, there were probably all kinds of other ties, but okay. Yeah, that'd be bad.
What about emotional reliance?
Oh, I'm a firm believer in that.
Okay.
I don't think anyone is completely emotionally reliant. Like you mean like self, what do you mean?
Well, reliance, like that you rely on somebody else. I think there's a difference between relying on somebody and depending on them. I think it's a difference of degrees, but I think there is a difference, right? Like we all, if we're going to have relationships,
we rely.
there's an emotional reliance, or we're expecting certain things from that person. You know, that's relying. Mm-hmm. Depending is like, hey, if you were ever gone, I would be, you know.
The system just fails. It breaks down.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no one's an island. I mean, we're social animals. We're going to interact and we're going to be emotional around other people. And you have to have some kind of reliance on other people. You have to have somebody that you can complain to and just get things off your chest or bounce ideas off of.
Well, of course. Yeah. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that I have any huge problem with Stoicism in and of itself, but I don't like anything that promotes, I guess, virtue is anything, because I'll go back and forth on what's virtuous all the time.
You want to get away from that word or talking about it, thinking about it? What are your feelings about
morality
that?
And virtue?
I don't like the word morality. No.
It's all very judgmental to say anything like that.
Right.
I'm a consequentialist. I want everyone to be left alone unless they want to, you know, cooperate and everything. And then that's great.
What would you say is like the importance of Stoic virtue, or the important aspects of Stoic virtue?
Well, I would say that once you arrive at the conclusion that the world isn't under any obligation to make you happy,
right?
Forgiveness becomes a lot easier. Magnanimity becomes a lot easier. Patience becomes a lot easier. Yeah.
Yeah. Gratitude.
Sure.
You know, and serenity when you realize that you live in a world of cause and effect, when you realize you live in a universe that's deterministic, you know?
Isn't that just growing up?
Yeah, you would think, I would think, but there's a lot of people who are not managing that very well, you know, and the state certainly doesn't help, you know, the legal system certainly doesn't help, but to evaluate a situation or evaluate adverse condition and say, well, these are the things that are within my control, these are the things that are not, and I'll direct my energy and attention and efforts to the things I can control. You have a reaction.
That's just growing up. Like, something bad happens, it's not the end of the world. Why? Because it's never been the end of the world before. And realizing that you can't control some aspects, it's just wisdom.
Right. Well,
I guess you can grow old without growing wise.
Well, there's two kinds of reactions to that, right? There's people who are pouting and they've got their hands on their hips and they're like, I can't believe it. Oh, gosh, you know? But or is it something that's more internal? Do people tend to punish themselves emotionally, like internally, in dealing with these difficult situations? It doesn't have to be a big freak out, you know? Like adults, adults have most bad situations happen and they don't cry, they don't freak out, they don't throw dishes. But what's going on internally? And I think Stoicism is often confused with the abandonment of emotions. And I think it's really the opposite. I think it's becoming comfortable enough with your emotions because you're able to face them. I wouldn't even say control them, but face them and manage them appropriately, right? Because like controlling emotions sounds like repressing emotions.
Indeed, it does.
And I don't think that's what it's about. I think that if people are not comfortable with their emotions, they're more likely to run away from them, right? With drugs or alcohol or some other kind of addictive or destructive behavior. I think people who can feel comfortable facing their emotions, those are the people least likely to abandon them or turn their backs on them.
Would you say that Stoics are less likely to be insulted by other people?
Absolutely. I wouldn't take it as a slight against me if somebody had an ill opinion of me.
Mm-hmm. At the end of one of these letters, Seneca said something I did like, which was, that which annoys us does not necessarily injure us, but we are driven into wild rage by our luxurious lives, so that whatever does not answer our whims arouses our anger. We don the temper of kings, for they too, forgetful alike of their own strength and of other men's weakness, grow white hot with rage, as if they had received an injury, when they are entirely protected from danger of such injury by their exalted station. They are not unaware that this is true, but by finding fault, they seize upon opportunities to do harm. They insist that they have received injuries in order that they may inflict them.
Yeah, that just sounds like a lifestyle obsession. Like, you don't know what you can't live without, and now you see some kind of inadequacy in others, and you just rail against it.
Mm. Yeah, people are so easily offended if they're just slightly annoyed.
Well, I mean, hyperbole has gone just through the roof with the rise of the internet. Like,
Yeah, that internet, I used to be all gung-ho internet, but now I'm not really sure what it's doing to us. So, I mean, where do you hear the stupidest, like, most racist, the spelling on there, it's atrocious. It's horrible.
Well, it's splitting us in two as a species. Almost.
I
think. Like, some people are using it for the things that, you know, like, some people are benefiting from it greatly.
The social justice warriors?
No.
And white shit with Ferguson, like, instead of cops and non-cop stuff.
Right, but there's people who aren't involved in any of that. They're not getting sucked into to any of that stuff.
Where do they hang out? Let me write that down.
Oh, well, you know. You're right. You're kind of right. Like, you're right about, I can see why you're jaded, or you sound jaded about the Facebook experience primarily, because it's bad. I would spend time on there and I would be sad and anxious, and I didn't like it. And I advise people, get away from it as much as you can. If I didn't have to maintain, you know, the groups and pages related to my show, I wouldn't be on there ever. I don't scroll through that newsfeed anymore, you know, at all. But I think there are people who are, you know, using this technology for, you know, enriching their own lives, enriching themselves.
Absolutely. And Bitcoin wouldn't really be possible without people having their smartphones, having the internet in their hands at all times.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, there's so many things that are just kind of accelerators on the road you're already on, you know, like money, coming into a bunch of money, right? Like, if you're already headed down the road the wrong way, the bad way, the not life enriching way for you, having a bunch of money is probably just going to be an accelerator on that road, in that direction you're already heading. alcohol, hallucinogens, the internet, technology, right? None of these things are turnarounds. None of these things like spin you around and send you the other way. Like, oh gosh, I was on my way to an early death, but now that I have alcohol and Facebook, I'm turning it around. You know, that doesn't happen. You know, all of these things that are like these sudden stimuli increases in life are just, you know, accelerators on the road you're already on, I think. So the people who already were, I don't know, apathetic or lazy or easily angered, yes, the internet is probably making life worse. But for people who were go-getters and entrepreneurial, their lives are probably getting better because this technology exists.
No, well, I think that former group, their lives are getting better too because they have like voices now on YouTube comments and they didn't have that before.
Yeah. Oh, wait, the shitty people?
Yeah, the shitty people.
Oh, gosh.
They now, it's voices for everyone, Brett.
It's going to be a level playing field between us and the shitties?
Us and the shitties.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
I was hoping it would just split. Like, I was hoping that they were going to be our slaves soon.
All the racists out there, they're all going to be our slaves.
Well, so, and talk about aestheticism. I mean, you said we're just overwhelmed with stimuli. Mm-hmm. Like, try that on for size. Just go without stimulus for like 10 minutes. Just sit in a quiet room and see how that feels.
That's called meditation.
You don't even have to meditate.
Sitting in a quiet room is meditation. What else are you going to do?
Mm.
You're not sleeping. You're not like walking.
Maybe observe the ceiling.
That's meditation.
It was a couple years
anyway,
ago.
It's meditation.
For me, I had to wait somewhere for somebody for like a half an hour and I had my phone. And then it died. And I remember sitting there and being like, this was like a turning point. This was like a wake-up call. I was sitting there and I was like, my phone died. And I knew I had to just sit there for like another half hour. And I said, well, this is quite sad. This is really, I'm not comfortable right now.
Now, why is that?
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
A word for that. It's monophobia.
Yeah. Well, no, but I never had that before. I would delight in my alone time, in my, you know, just time with myself. I used to love that. I would make up
like as a teenager.
Well, growing up, yeah. I mean, I grew up without the internet. I'm 37, so
how long have you had a smartphone?
3 years, 4 years, maybe.
Okay, so that was the first time in 3 or 4 years that you had that was your first symptom of monophobia.
Yeah, I think so.
It's not mono. It's nomophobia.
Nomophobia.
Yes, someone in the UK made it up, and it is fear of not being connected to like the online world. Phone, laptop, if you have like no connection. And I've gotten that feeling before too, when I'm like out on a boat for several days, like all kinds of things could be happening out there and I don't know about it. Breathe. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to be okay.
Yeah. You're in a boat.
Yeah. And I'm on a boat.
If something goes down, that's where, first of all, just you're on a boat. Life's better on a boat than not on a boat.
Exactly. Yeah.
Number two, if shit goes down, you're on a boat, you know?
Unless, wait, I don't want the boat. Wait, oh, that shit.
Right. So unless it's an asteroid, you know, hitting the ocean somewhere.
Or a hurricane.
Or a hurricane, sure. But of all the things that could go down, that's only two things. So what are the odds that's going to be one of those things?
Well, the boat itself.
Oh, the boat.
The boat could go down.
The boat could go down. Three things to worry about on a boat.
We did. The last time I was on a boat, we took a little like, it starts with a P. Pontoon.
Sure.
Yeah.
Out there with like 12 people and all our bags. And we started drowning on the way to the boat that we were going to spend the night on.
Okay.
So yeah, that wasn't fun. I had my laptop with me. Speaking of nomophobia, why did I have my laptop with me? I don't know. It's an electronic typewriter while I'm on the boat. We weren't going to have Wi-Fi or anything. And I stood in the very middle with my laptop hugged to my chest. And because it was going to be the last thing that was going to get wet.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Because too many people were like not balancing this thing. Like, no, you get on that side. You get on that side. And yes, I was pretty scared.
Wow.
Now, what would have happened? No, it wouldn't have been that bad. But I shouldn't just go around doing bad things, like, so that I will realize they're not that bad. I know they're not. Like, Nick and I were discussing, like, you know, facing death, right?
Yes.
That's one of the, you can face death. First of all, I don't like that death is kind of, like, anthropomorphized in this, like, religious way to me. Anything that has any hint of religiosity wafting off of it, I question immediately.
Yeah.
No, Catholic school did not damage me at all. But the, yes, facing death. Okay. Well, I, you know, flatlined on the table in surgery when I was 9 because my appendix blew up inside my body because my mother wasn't listening to me. I slipped on a wet pool, like not pool service, but you know, around the pool. Mm-hmm. Don't run. Yeah. This girl. So slipped and smacked the back of my head and lost consciousness. I almost drowned out at sea one time. You know, so I've faced death plenty of times. Why go out of my way to face it? I either can face it, woohoo, yay, high self-esteem, go about my business, or I can't face it and I'm dead.
Right. So how, go ahead.
Well, I mean, if you've already faced it, you don't have to like seek it out. If you come to grips with your own mortality, there's no reason to like do some craziness to face death again.
Hasn't everyone almost died like a bunch of times? Weren't we all kids?
I don't think so. I'm reminded of the story of Buddha. He spent like 20 years living in his father's palace and never knew any suffering until he snuck out one day.
That's you?
No, that's not me. I'm not Buddha.
I was under the impression that most people have almost died a bazillion times. Have you seen what kids do?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure, I think most of my near-death experiences were as a teenager.
And teenagers and young adults.
A teenager unable to obtain certain drugs. And then, like, doing experiments at the pharmacy.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. There probably a couple times I was closer than I realized, you know, like tripping on.
But you didn't realize it. Because then you're not facing death if you don't realize it.
No, but like the next day, you know, sitting around with your friends going, we shouldn't have done that. We could have died.
Yeah.
I feel like death has been easier to face. I was, I had an experience earlier this year where I couldn't swallow anything. And that's like, I'm thinking, well, this must be, and I'm also kind of a hypochondriac.
So kind of.
This must be the worst thing this could possibly be. And, you know, I had really gotten in my own head about it, and I had convinced myself that, like, this was it. You know, I really had. And, you know, I went and I had tests done, cameras down my throat and stuff, and I turned out to be fine. But that was really, for me, coming to grips with the idea that, you know, I could die.
See, yeah. Now, some people might call you mad, right? Like, yes, like psychologically ill or something, but you just faced death.
Yeah, yeah. And I think
it was just an exercise.
As I felt like I achieved more things in life, death was easier to face. I think we always, even if it's like subconsciously or subtly, maybe not subconsciously, but on a subtle level, we always accept that we're going to die. You know, that's how we kind of protect ourselves.
Like, I don't know about that. You know? I think I know myself when I was a teenager, I thought I was invincible. I thought I was going to live forever. Nothing can hurt me.
Yeah. I mean, I behave that way. But I think as I did more things that I was happy with, that I was proud of, it got easier to face death. Like, okay, well, I mean, think about it. If we all die, right? And then someday there's like a voluntary world, we'll be like,
I would not be proud of anything I did, anything I accomplished, and, you know,
really?
Work or whatever. No, my take on it, I mean, of course I'd be dead, but it would be just like, I had a good time.
But if your work that went on to inspire a voluntary culture, you wouldn't see that as somehow your agency living on past your beating heart?
I really like that. Efficacy, like, beyond your time on Earth, that's like an amazing thing.
I don't care about that at all because I'm dead.
I know, but
I don't care about the idea of legacy.
But what if we just meditated on it right now and it's like 1,000 years from now and people are talking, because people will know who we are. If the internet is preserved, people will know your name and mine.
Everything is being sent out right now.
And they'll be having arguments about us like we had almost about Seneca. And they'll be like, oh, one time Brett Vinod said this. And it's like, yeah, but did you ever hear him on Puke in the Gang when he did this? You know? And
yeah, that fart joke. Yeah, that
exactly.
Was really good.
Right. And then they'll debate. So I look forward to that.
You cannot look forward to it.
I look forward to that for them, too.
For them. Just think of them.
Yeah. To live vicariously.
I don't get that. Maybe, I don't know. I've always known that I'm not going to be a breeder, so maybe that plays into it a little bit. I really don't care about the concept of legacy. And I've been told, oh, I feel bad for you because that means you don't matter. Like, what? Oh, wow. Well, I'm going to go full circle here with you because he said that means I don't matter because I'm taking myself out of the gene pool. And I told him I can still have, you know, agency or whatever. Like, I have a show that's going to be like, that's information that's just out there forever. That was my comeback to him, but I really don't care about that. I don't care about leaving children. I don't think my genes are so awesome that the human race could really, really better themselves with critters of mine running around.
Is that, in this person's mind, I'm wondering, is that guaranteeing that you will matter if you procreate? What does that even mean?
Well, I think they're probably just envisioning like a grandchild of them just being the next John Connor or something, like some savior for mankind. And it's all going to be because of some quirk or trait that's unique to them that's really going to come in handy in the clutch.
Sure. Yeah. I don't think that way.
Yeah, it seems very unlikely.
I'll have to ask the guy what he meant by that. He only has one son.
Yeah, that's another important question.
You got to protect your precious.
Well, is there a scale of mattering based on?
Yeah, so he should love Octomom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right, where are we going to go from here?
Well, we were talking, that was almost entirely based on Stoicism, right? So I don't know if Stoicism was leading into a discussion about Bill and some of the things he said on my show. I know you wanted to touch on that.
I think we talked about everything about Stoicism that I wanted to talk about. I want to focus more on the lack of empathy and where that's gotten us.
Okay. All right.
Because, I mean, the state in general lacks empathy.
Oh, sure.
I was reading on The Art of Manliness about empathy, and they had a study on there that I really liked. They had people play a game with lab assistants, and then they put the lab assistants through physical pain. And they measured the subject's empathy levels. They measured their brainwaves. Everyone felt empathy for these people they had just played a game with. Mm-hmm. They do it again, but this time the lab assistants are cheating at the game. This time, when physical pain is administered to the lab assistants, the women's brains still show the same empathy, and the men's brains no longer show that level of empathy.
Were there any conclusions about why that is?
It did say that the same, not the same test, but the same kind of test had been run on mice, and the gender difference also holds true in mice, and the gap closes as people age. It doesn't close, but it narrows as men and women age.
Interesting.
So that would say that it's not evolutionary? Because I was thinking, you know, more during, you know, war times where everyone was a warrior, big warrior cultures like the Roman Empire, where a lot of these people were writing these things, that a lack of empathy would be useful so that you can look at another man, someone who looks just like you, and kill them on the field.
Mm-hmm.
But if it holds true in mice...
But even I would even think that that was a relatively small. I mean, there's always been a division of labor, you know, save for some cultures like.
Is there a division of labor in mice? I mean, there's the actual progeny.
I mean, well, we're talking.
Those things don't live very long, do they?
No.
I mice? Think they
no.
just they're born, they procreate, they die.
Yeah, they don't get time for empathy.
They don't get.
But I mean, as far as, you know,
I'm sure some animal lovers out there are really upset.
Even in the short term, like traits of human beings. I would think it would have to go back to a time when nothing in recorded history, it would all predate that, when, yes, men had a certain role and women didn't have that role, right? Because if we're talking about like the Roman Empire, you know, how many people are in the legions? 5%, 10%? I mean, let's say it's 15% of men, right? Because they still have a division of labor where all these other things have to be done. So, you know, there's Genghis Khan. Who are they? The
Mongols.
Mongols.
Warriors. But if you, there were also a lot of slaves.
Yeah.
Right? So you got to include those.
Okay.
I mean, you need to not have empathy to treat someone as your personal slave.
I kind of wonder if there's a compartmentalization that can take place there.
Well, that is what lacking empathy is. I mean, it's compartmentalization. Like, you can loosen that. It's not like you're either empathic or you're not.
Right.
It's something that's fluid throughout someone's life.
Okay.
So it is something you can look at.
Sure. All right. Yeah. So I think that there's an evolutionary component to it as well. When it comes to not even maybe killing other people, but killing things, you know.
I don't look forward to the day where I may have to kill an animal, even a chicken. I don't want to.
Yeah, chicken.
But I know a lot of men who will do that. No problem. I mean, I'll do it if I have to.
Yeah, see, I don't look forward to killing anything either, but a chicken would be like the thing that would bother me.
The thing that would...
The least?
The least, right. Yeah, okay. Chicken is a good place to start. That's why I mentioned chicken.
Well, yeah, I'm once you've and mastered then, like, the bug world, yeah, then you would move up to a chicken, yeah. I think.
I'm talking about killing something because I have to eat it.
Yeah, chicken, easiest.
How about, I just found out like 2 years ago that people eat squirrel.
Yeah.
Would squirrel be easier than chicken?
Yeah, for me.
No, it would be harder.
No, it would be harder. Yeah, that's what I meant. It would be harder for me.
Check your mammalian privilege.
Something like that.
I think it'd be easier to kill a bird than a mammal, even if, yeah.
It's real easy to kill a frog. Like, I fry up some frog legs. Delicious.
Fish.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, you're going to start with fish.
Yeah, start with fish.
Mm-hmm.
I've never killed a fish either. All right, anyway, I need to go out and kill things. But no, we're talking about working our empathy muscles, and now we're talking about going and killing things.
Yeah, good practical advice. As you work your way up to more advanced types of killing, Start with fish, get comfortable there, move on to frogs, try a chicken. When you think you're ready for a squirrel, do a squirrel. And
then go start a war.
And join the army.
I mean, once you're in the mammals, you got your cows, your pigs. Like, you got a full breakfast right there for you.
Yes.
Until you go join the army. Yeah. That's where you put those people. Supposedly, I've heard. Again, a dark, dark place. So, but the lack of empathy makes people, or not the, okay. When someone lacks empathy, they, like, the opposite side of that is being very systemized, a systemized mind, right?
Okay.
And that mind wants to keep things in balance, justice, and fairness. So when these guys did not have the empathy for those lab assistants because they had cheated at the game, that was because they thought things were balanced, even though they weren't getting anything. They weren't benefiting out of the fact that this person was going through physical pain.
Right, yeah.
Cheating at a game and physical pain are not proportional to each other.
But there was like this political thing to it where it's like, oh, they're bad. Oh, they're being punished. Good. I like it when bad people are punished.
And hence we have the prison system.
Well, that's what politics is all about. It's fantasizing about bad things happening to people you don't like. I mean, I don't think it's about anything else.
So even though politics is supposed to be about how we organize society and maybe how we take care of each other, it's really people with a lack of empathy that are interested in politics at all?
Yeah, I think it's like an outlet for trauma. I really believe that. I mean, listen to any political discourse from either side in the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all just about being angry and hoping bad things are going to happen to the people you don't like. There's nothing like, once we get elected, wait till you see the good things we're going to do. It's all about, once we get elected, now, sometimes it's more subtle, but it's like, once we get elected, wait till you see who gets punished. There's always that subtext. Even with all the fluffy, nice rhetoric, somebody is going to be the victim of that. It's always there.
So you're saying that politics in general just lacks magnanimity?
Yes.
That's tonight's word. I didn't know what it was before Nick started using it. I just thought it was being generous, but it's being generous to a rival or someone lesser than you. I don't know.
Weaker.
Mag means great. So anytime a word has mag in it, except maggot.
Mm.
Mag as a Latin root means maggot. Great. Magnify.
Magazine?
Yeah, if you trace it back to its meaning, it probably has something to do.
Probably. Everything except for maggot.
Everything except for maggot.
So what about politics and magnanimity?
Oh, it's all about getting into power so you can punish those who you don't like.
Oh, yes. That reminds me of the Gospel of Louis C.K., well-known comedian.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
He's making dinner for his two daughters. He has an extra slice of mango. He gives it to the older one. The daughter one gives it to the older one. The younger one says, wait, I want one too. Like, he says, that was the last one. I don't have one. And she says, well, then that means she shouldn't have one. I'm like, why? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Well, it's not fair. And it's like, well, that's just not how things work. Things aren't fair. You never look into your neighbor's bowl unless you're checking to see if they have enough.
Ah, I like that.
That is good.
It's the Gospel according to Louis C.K. We have like neighborhoods where people are, you know, looking at each other because...
That's stoicism, though. What you just described is an example of the sphere of control, right? Never look into your neighbor's bowl unless you're checking to see if they have enough, right?
You're saying that that's stoicism.
It is stoicism.
All right, you have to convince me.
All right. If you're looking into your neighbor's bowl to say, well, I hope they don't have more than me, you know, that's directing your focus into something you can't control. But if you're doing it to say, I want to make sure they have enough and I can provide it, then you're operating within your sphere of control.
Not only that, but if you're a Stoic, you're not worried about how much food they have versus as long as you have enough.
Yeah.
Like, just for the sake of a comparison, you have enough, everything else should become irrelevant. Unless, of course, you care very deeply about feeding that person.
Or all people.
Sure.
Well, I mean, I do think we live in a world where we could feed all people, you know, if
yes.
you got away from all that. All right. Well, I guess I'm okay with Stoicism.
Yeah, I think there's a lot. I don't think that I wanted to introduce it on my show because I think there's a lot of good things there that people should think about. I'm not saying that it's a philosophy that people have to, you know,
fully
embrace.
I wasn't saying that.
Right. And I don't think philosophy is really like a buffet either, where you just pick and choose like little things from. I mean, I think you need to strive for consistency in whatever you believe.
Not inconsequentialism.
Okay, tell me, can you tell me more? Because I actually, I don't know that much about it. I've talked about it a little bit on my show.
It's just
I'm certainly
a
not.
Perspective that I take everything on a case-by-case basis.
Mm-hmm.
If you take any government action, you know, to its logical conclusion, like abortion, if you want to make abortion illegal, you're going to have to test every woman every 28 days. And if she has irregular periods, then you're going to have to, you know, keep her in a room somewhere so you can, like, check all of that. Like, what it actually means to make certain behaviors illegal is crazy.
So it's an
and hence no government.
So in philosophy, it's really dealing with the branch of ethics, consequentialism, right? Or am I wrong? Ethics, it's really like in the ethical and political realm. Mm-hmm. Of philosophy. I'm only like, when we were talking about objective.
Are you talking about what you think is right?
Well, the five branches of philosophy for people who are unfamiliar is, I mean, just real, real simple distillation. Metaphysics, what exists? Epistemology, how do we know? Ethics, what should we do about it? Politics, how should we use it in society? And aesthetics, how should it be represented or recorded? That's very, very, very simple. But when I talk about objectivism, I'm really only an objectivist through the first three, right? Which is, you know, there's an objective reality outside of me, I believe, that I can interface with through my reason. And the ethics for me is rational self-interest, right? But I don't know where how comprehensive consequentialism is, because I've never really studied it. Does it have a metaphysics? Does it have an epistemology?
I haven't studied it in that way,
right,
at all.
Okay, all right.
It's just, you know, a language that has come up. Dan D'Amico considers himself one, and I agree with a lot of the arguments that I've seen online of his. I don't know of any like olden writers about it or what have you. It's just my position. Well, or it could just be seen as rational self-interest all the way across, because my position is whatever benefits me. However, I also don't think that the best way to benefit me is to only benefit me, because
sure, yeah.
The best thing is for all situations to be situations in which everyone benefits. Because if only one benefits, then, you know, in the future that leads to other issues and resentments and et cetera. So the way I live my life, I'm looking for win situations for everyone involved.
Yes, absolutely. Totally.
Well, and not even just win-win, but many wins beyond that, you know, and it's exhausting.
Now, do you think about everything? Consequentialists could have a metaphysical philosophy at all? I mean, because if you're taking everything by a case-by-case basis, you might be sure that this reality exists right now, but the second or moment from now...
I don't have a notion about objective reality. I think we live here where we all have kind of agreed on what this is, but just like children do things that you would never do as an adult, like we all just kind of agreed that we're not going to behave that way. And that, you know, how we're sitting, what we're doing here, that this is all appropriate. I don't think there's an objective reality. I think schizophrenics and all of those people are all valid as well. And just expressing themselves differently. I don't think there's a way to be sane. So...
But you could explain through like, you know, using reason, I mean, to a schizophrenic and through instrumentation, you could demonstrate that most of what they're experiencing is hallucination.
What's to say I just can't see it?
Okay.
Yeah, I'm totally open to all the shamanistic stuff.
Okay, I tend not to be. I'm here.
Just because it's not real to you.
But it's just like, I've never understood the usefulness of any of it, right? Like, it's all just kind of candy land to me, you know? Like, this is where we are. This is what's real. This is how we can, you know, interface with that. Like, if an alien species came here and they had 9 senses, then yeah, maybe we'd have to have a conversation about what exists. And it's not to say that we're done.
We have more than 5.
Right? Absolutely.
Proprioceptic. There's a bunch of others.
Yeah. So all senses plus instrumentation, right, to deal with things like, you know, frequencies on the sound spectrum that we can't hear or light that we can't see.
Right. We're still studying all of that.
Right. So I'm not saying that we're done either. 2000 years ago, there was no microbiological world that was all magic. That was Candyland. I just used Candyland. I don't know.
You used it twice. I'm not exactly sure. I know it was a board game. It's also the name of the plantation on Django Unchained.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Okay. Dark. I just use it for discussions of like.
It means magical.
Magical. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's nice. Yeah. Magical Candyland. So
I don't want to limit myself, just like I didn't limit myself to my life being school, cubicle, marriage, babies, social security not there, and death,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to make other assumptions. I'm being more fluid these days with all of that stuff. Although any like semblance of Christianity will really like put me on guard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because of?
Because I went to Catholic school.
Yeah, I was raised Catholic.
All those, like, talk about compartmentalization, you know, yeah. and people using God as a reason to go to war or, you know, kill people that like to have different sex than them, etc. Like, you know, my dad, like, they put me in therapy in Catholic school because my dad was gay.
Yeah.
Yep. That wasn't a problem for me or anything. So yeah, I'm pretty resentful of that.
My attitude about religion has changed a lot because I just see it as a vehicle to get good or bad people where they want to go. Like if somebody wakes up in the morning and they say, you know, well, today I'm going to start a war against, you know, some brown people. And
right.
I'm going to have sex.
They don't
with
do
some,
that.
I'm going to have sex with some kids, right? They're going to find, if that's their impulse, you know, that they're going to find a way to do that. They're going to find some other excuse to do those things. People always have. People who weren't religious. I was just talking about like, you know, like the Fabian Society on my show, like, and all these people who have these megalomaniacal designs on the world, like they would tell themselves, they would come up with some other supernatural shit. Like, oh, we're descendant from the Merovingians, you know, so we have a claim, that kind of stuff. So
right.
I think it's just a vehicle to get bad people where they want to go with this ultimate appeal to authority. God, this is the will of God.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think it gets a lot of good people where they want to go too, but they just have never known any other way to get there because they don't see that.
But does it really count as getting there? Like the two things I wrote down were AA.
Okay, what about it?
And charity. Like AA, that could be, and I know it's only like a 5%, 5 to 10% success rate. But in order to make your life better, drop the booze.
Yeah.
You need to give up your power to a higher power. It's, you know, very Christian. So they could be making their lives better by changing their health and reconstructing their relationships.
Yeah.
But they're doing it by giving up their own power, their own agency.
It has a collectivism and self-sacrifice aspect to it that would be, you know, that would remind people of a lot of religions. But there's nothing, you know, there's, I just want to make sure there's nothing Christian about AA necessarily. Like you have to accept Jesus.
No, but you do need to give up your power to a higher power.
Sure.
And that's just very sad. When people do things because Jesus, and they're only doing things because Jesus, I don't know, does it really count the benefits that they're getting out of that? Maybe. And if they're like feeding the homeless because Jesus, awesome, that benefits me.
Right. So it's like the Mother Teresa thing. Did she really do anything good if she was hallucinating that angels were telling her to do these things? You know, is that really virtuous? Well, that was her, right?
I don't know about the hallucinations, but as Nick and I have been talking about all night, Penn and Teller, because I think we've both seen every one, they had one where they discussed Mother Teresa, and she was not all that great.
No, absolutely not. Christopher Hitchens did a lot of investigation into her as well.
Yeah. I like that guy. I found out about him like 2 weeks after he died.
Oh, that's too bad. Shame.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't read any like books yet, but just all the YouTube videos of just him like giving the verbal smackdown again and again and again. It's awesome.
The hitch slap.
Yep. Super great. Okay. So I guess that was our show on Stoicism. I suppose I'm a fan.
What did we not get to anything?
Did we not get to anything?
Are we up against a hard break?
I think we covered a lot of bases.
We did. We did cover a lot.
Do you have any final remarks?
No.
No.
My final remark is I just want to make sure we covered everything. And I think maybe we did.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the state is a lack of empathy. I mean, maybe that's something I should talk to some leftists about. How can, like, there cannot be a benevolent state, right? We've all agreed.
The system can't have a conscience.
It can't.
We've all agreed.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, that would be an interesting question to pose to, like, the progressives.
And, you know, the Occupy folks, the anarcho-socialist folks, like, how do you expect to, like, have a system to do that?
Right.
Because, yeah. I mean, if they believe in redistributing anything, you can't have anarcho and redistribution in the same sentence.
Right.
And some people do have that issue.
I'm an anarcho-redistributor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Peacefully.
Right.
Peaceful redistribution. Right. Voluntary.
So I'm just looking for ways to have more people around and saying important things that aren't just libertarians, because I don't want to use the word libertarian, right?
Right.
When people realize that empathy and cooperation are more important these days than competition and the rat race and producing, like people that get all upset about welfare recipients.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a country where less than half of people who are of productive age, like in the, you know, capitalistic go to work 9 to 5 way, are actually being productive.
Mm-hmm.
They're bureaucrats or they're on the dole. You know, I mean, if you're working in the DMV, I'm not counting that as being productive. France's numbers are 20%. So we're already having places where people aren't doing anything. And I'm not saying you should any money should be stolen from anyone else.
Right. Yeah.
But we have all this wealth as a society where we don't have to overwork and do the rat race thing, because that's where, I'm going all over the place now with capitalism and competition, rat race, people killing themselves over work and being overworked, et cetera. And then you hate the people that are on the dole.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, it's a miserable, horrible existence.
Right. And there's no common ground, right? Like, I that's one of the things that's always bothered me the most about, these people on welfare.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, you know, they're experiencing the same discomforts you are in life, right? It's just that we have a common enemy.
Yeah.
That we need to look at sooner or later. That's why these groups are pitted against each other, so people never see that common enemy.
Right.
Yeah.
So people who use their EBT cards at the store against people who do not, just like, you know, like the South pit poor whites against poor blacks, and the rich benefited off of all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And like, if the poor all got together and looked at who the real problem was, you know, that would have blown their whole game.
It makes me, not to get all conspiratorial, but it makes me wonder what's coming down the pipe in America in the next couple of years, because there are a lot of people right now who really seem to be excited about the possibility of a race war. Why? And this war on women, you know, I'm wondering what's that.
It's always been a war, like drug war, war on poverty, right? These are old ideas.
Yeah. But like, there is like a lot of encouragement, like even, you know, in people who are outside of the mainstream, there seems to be a lot of momentum towards a race war.
Do you mean race war or just anti-white men war?
No, a blacks versus whites, whites hating blacks, blacks hating whites. Like, do people not see this? Am I
so
paranoid?
Is that like,
I don't see it at all.
Is that like Ferguson centric? Because I know I just, some guy I met at Porkfest and we became friends on Facebook. He went down to Ferguson, not recently, not on Facebook, so I don't know. But he went a couple months ago.
Yeah.
And he kept posting from there and putting up videos. And he said, people are starting to realize it's not black against white. It's blue against non-blue.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was his impression from, you know, being on the ground there. So I know that you're here. If you're getting that impression from like media and the internet, well, I mean, there's your conspiracy, right?
Yeah.
Because that's how they want to portray it, I think.
I feel like within the last couple of years, too, there was all this news about this new game that black teens are playing in the city where they go up and knock somebody out. Do you remember this?
The knockout game.
The knockout. And I was like, is that real? And then there was like all this, you know, debate about whether it was real or not. Like if it was really a problem, if it was really going on. And it seemed like it was about stoking fear and paranoia and anger. And, you know, this Ferguson thing is another example of that. There's other examples, too, that I'm forgetting about. But has it always been this way? Is this just,
how about a war on teenagers?
Yeah, that's not new.
Right. With schools and taking all their stuff and imprisoning them for Pop-Tarts. No, that was someone really young. But it's pitting everyone against everyone except for the government, the cops.
Exactly.
It's all distractions. And that's one of the things I said about the whole privilege mongering talk, all of it. It's not only is it unimportant, it's a major distraction.
Yeah. And it's obvious why, too, because who are you going to run to when the people we've pitted against you come after you? You know, the cops or the state.
Quite shameful. Yeah. Just a few bad apples.
Well, how can we turn that around into a big positive finish?
Well, if everybody was a stoic, you wouldn't care about the enemy of yours that you were getting pitted against, and you would just, you know, keep living, I guess.
Well, I mean, I have at least a tiny bit of care for everyone. I don't want bad things to happen to them unless they're, you know, cops or military or Obama or something. Those are the people that are going to hurt me. Ooh. I'm not going to get shot walking down the street by a cop. I might. I'm not going to get shot by like a person. If I were to get shot by just like a person, I'd probably know that person. There's an 80% chance that I'd know that person and probably had pissed him off or like whatever. You know, it's what's the number? You are 8 times as likely to die by a cop than you are by a like a criminal,
terrorist.
A terrorist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that wasn't positive. Okay, positive.
God grant me the serenity. Want to do the serenity prayer? That's very stoic. It's Christian, but it's very stoic.
It is.
It is pretty stoic.
Yeah.
Grant me the serenity to change.
To accept the things I cannot change. The courage to change the things I can.
And the wisdom to know the difference.
Cut.
All right. I don't know any prayers. All righty. Well, thank you, Nick and Brett, for discussing stoicism and empathy and Candyland.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thanks
for
having
me. Thank you very much.
And you can find us on Facebook, which is now a ghost account. No one runs it. So, yeah, Lauren can post on it. I can't. But so you can find us there. And Twitter and iTunes. You've been listening to Sex, Lies, and Anarchy, where liberty gets personal.